copies of these paintings means either that he photographed and then copied them after he stole them, so he could show them to prospective clients, Vianello finished for him, or that he was given the photocopies by someone else to show him exactly which paintings to take, Brunetti finished. And this time Vianello nodded. They sat silent for a while, considering possibilities. What has his wife said?
Nothing. She said he thought her husband sold fire insurance, Vianello said with a straight face.
Fire insurance? Brunetti asked.
How did she explain the things in their house?
She didn't. She said her husband had always had good taste.
Who called to report the domestic violence?
The people in the apartment across from them, Vianello answered.
How does he explain the objects in the apartment? Brunetti asked.
Straight-faced, Vianello said,
some of them were in a briefcase he found on a train,
but didn't report finding.
He said he didn't think there was any law that said he had to.
Brunetti ignored this and asked,
does he have a history with us? He's been arrested for burglary 7 times. 6 years in jail, total.
Did anyone ask him about the photocopies?
Yes. He said he didn't want to throw them away because if he ever found the owner of the briefcase, he'd probably want to get everything back.
It took Brunetti some time to answer, and when he did, all he could think of was to say,
I see.
Then he asked, will you talk to him about these? Tapping a finger on the girl with different-sized eyes.
Tomorrow. Pastore said I could have a half hour with him while they're on their coffee break.
Long break, Brunetti observed.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
Vianello agreed.
I figured it could take some time to persuade him that it might be wise to agree to a trade. He tells me where he got the photocopies, and I tell my friends he's been cooperative with us.
Brunetti picked up the photocopies one by one and studied them. The frame on the portrait of the woman under the umbrella was simple black, undecorated. The woman wiping her feet was surrounded by a golden frame, ornamented with tiny carved wooden rosettes. The photocopy of the painting of the woman with the strange eyes showed it had been unframed. He went back and looked at the naked woman, and noticed that on the far right, at a small distance from the tiny rosettes of her frame, a thin black vertical bar led to the side of the photocopy and seemed to extend both above and below the painting. The woman with the odd eyes had the same black bar a bit to the left of the unframed edge of her portrait. As with the other painting, the black bar extended above and below the edge of the portrait. Brunetti stared at the three paintings for a long time. He then picked up the photocopy of the woman under the umbrella and folded the sheet of paper vertically so that the black frame of the painting was at the edge of the photocopy as well. He took the other two photos and folded their sides vertically so that the black frame of the center painting became the black vertical bars that ran so close to the sides of the other paintings. He set them in a horizontal row, and they became a sort of female triptych, the black frame of the central portrait now equidistant from and longer than the other two paintings. Brunetti looked at Vianello.
Is this the way they were hanging in Bordoni's apartment?
The inspector nodded and smiled.
You're very clever, Guido. It took me much longer, and I had to call Bocchese to look at the photo Dottor Bordoni gave us of how the paintings were originally hung.
So the original photo was taken in their home? Before the robbery?
Presumably.
Brunetti studied the three photocopies again. In a house as filled with art and paintings as the Bordoni's, a thief would have far less trouble if he had a road map with easily understandable signs.
"This is what you want to trade?" Brunetti asked.
"Exactly what I told you, Guido. He gives me the name of the person who took the photo, and in return I speak a few words to my friends."
"Will your friends agree?" Brunetti asked.
Startled by the question, Vianello sat up straight.
"They already have. They'll speak to the magistrate and explain that he's been a very helpful witness."
Brunetti smiled and said, "I'm surprised you didn't ask them to tell the magistrate he probably did find the bag on a train."
"I thought about it,"
Vianello said in a voice filled with regret.
"But with the record he has, my friends weren't willing to go that far."
Chapter 15 Brunetti looked at his watch and asked Vianello,
"You doing anything now?"
"No."
"Good. You want to come over to the Albertini with me?"
Vianello got to his feet.
"I'd like to see what happens when the kids get out of school," Brunetti said. "Chiara gets out at 5, so maybe they do too."
"All right, let me get my coat. I'll meet you downstairs,"
the inspector said and started towards the door. Minutes later they left the Questura and turned automatically in the direction of the school, in Barbaria delle Tole, not far from the hospital. Brunetti remembered playing soccer, badly, in the Campo as a student, but could no longer remember the friends with whom he had played. They crossed the bridge in front of Palazzo Capello and kept on straight until they turned to head up to the school.
"What are we looking for?"
Vianello asked.
"I'm not sure what someone selling drugs would look like."
Brunetti shrugged.
"Neither am I. There's been no mention of Fornari since he was released from jail a year and a half ago. Yet he's supposed to be in charge of drugs at the school."
He slowed and turned to look at his friend.
"What do you think that means?"
Vianello stopped in front of a shop on the right and looked at a squat brown vase in the window.
"The older I get, the more I like Japanese objects,"
he said, to Brunetti's considerable surprise.
"Why?"
Vianello rubbed at his bottom lip as he thought about this.
"They're so uncomplicated. So simple."
"Perhaps not to the Japanese," Brunetti said.
"But to Venetian policemen I think they are," Vianello said.
"Look at that," he added, pointing down at the vase.
"It looks like it's glowing, doesn't it? As if there were something burning inside."
When Brunetti did not answer, Vianello stuffed his hands in the pockets of his trousers and turned away from the window to resume walking.
"It could mean he's franchised the work to someone else,"
Vianello continued, as if he had not stopped to look into the window.
"It could be he's tired of being in jail."
"He should be," Brunetti agreed, "after all those years."
In the information Signorina Elettra had provided on Fornari, there had not been much to his life when he had not been in prison. They passed the gates of the school, open to the calle. No students were to be seen in the large courtyard. The only sign of life was a border collie sitting alert in the far left corner, as though it had parked its flock and was waiting for the time on the meter to run out. There were benches in the campo. They'd be less conspicuous if they were sitting there reading the papers, so Brunetti stopped at the kiosk and saw that there were no newspapers left. He bought a second copy of the Espresso they already had at home, and a 2-month-old Giornale dell'Arte, which he passed to Vianello. They sat on a bench that faced down the calle that led to the school and began to read. Minutes passed. They flipped through the pages, occasionally glancing towards the school to see if any students had appeared. After another 10 minutes, Brunetti found himself involved in an article about the former director of the Mose Project, now living in Central America and claiming to be too infirm to return to Italy for trial. Over the years, Brunetti had read reports of the total spent on the project that varied from 5 to 7 billion euros, and now this one suggested quite calmly the possibility that the Progetto Faraonico would never function. Just like that. Millennium-old tidal patterns destroyed, vast areas of land and sea covered with cement, an unknown quantity spent, and now they blithely announce it might never work. He turned the page. A low noise, reminiscent of the sound of surf, made them look up at the same time, and they saw and heard Exodus. The chosen ones of an expensive private school were heading towards the Campo in a wide wave of Montclair and North Face. Gray, dark gray, black, dark blue, and almost all of them wearing jeans so dilapidated and shredded that they would have outraged their family's cleaning women, for surely the families of these boys and girls would have cleaning women. The boys were tall and lanky, most of them. The girls apparently easy in their company. Some walked side by side, either as friends or as couples. Brunetti knew the difference, but didn't know why he knew it. Perhaps it was what the boy touched when he put his arm around the girl. A general murmur, interspersed with the sharp crash of laughter, preceded them. The wave approached. In the midst of it, 1 centimeter from the heels of a tall, dark-haired girl, and looking like a bit of flotsam, quick-stepped the border collie. Tongue lolling in adoration, the dog occasionally glanced up at her before shifting minimally in response to some signal from the flock. As they entered the campo, a few of the students broke free and went into the tobacco shop to emerge with small packs of cigarettes, which they opened to offer their classmates. Others drifted toward the kiosk where Brunetti had bought the magazines. They paid and took the magazines the Asian man inside the kiosk gave them. When was it, Brunetti wondered, that kiosks had ceased to sell primarily newspapers and magazines, and now sold compact discs, trinkets, keychains, and T-shirts? And when had the men inside ceased to be Italian? The wave washed past them and splashed out into the campo. Some went into the bars for a coffee or a coke. Others continued across to climb the bridge and disappear down the other side. As he studied them, Brunetti watched to see if an adult approached any of them, or if, in fact, any of the adults in the campo paid attention to them. It seemed not. A boy with gleaming black hair that came down to his shirt collar pushed open the door of Rosa Salva and moved towards the bridge. He'd taken only a few steps when a girl shoved open the door and started after him, shouting,
"Giampaolo, wait for me!"
He turned but did not smile, and she began to run in his direction. Brunetti looked away.
"She'll learn," Vianello said.
Then, after a moment, he added,
"Or else you won't."
Brunetti set the magazine on the bench beside him, folded his arms over his chest, and turned his attention to the last building in the row that started with Rosa Salva. From the windows of the 4th floor, a person could easily see the mountains as well as the facades of the hospital and the basilica that lay there as visual gifts. For decades he had envied the people who lived in the apartment. He studied the windows and thought about what the kids had done when they entered the campo. Turning his head to Vianello, Brunetti asked,
"You ever know boys to read scandal magazines?"
"Read what?"
"Those magazines that have pictures of actors and actresses, and 6-page spreads of George Clooney's wedding."
"Oh, sweet Jesus, don't remind me of that."
Dianello, who had worked double shifts for 4 days during the festivities some years before, implored him. He gave a little shake of horror to dismiss the memory.
"Why do you ask?"
"Because 4 boys just bought magazines like that. And they paid 20 euros for each of them."
"How do you know?"
"Because I watched. They each paid with a 20-euro note,
took the magazines, and didn't bother to wait for the change.
Very interesting,
Vianello said. Brunetti, whose feet had grown cold while they sat, stamped them on the ground a few times.
All they'd have to do is agree on names and amounts. A certain magazine means a particular drug, and a certain number of copies means the amount of the drug the buyer wants. At the end of the day, the man in the kiosk sends an order in an SMS, and the requested magazines get delivered the next day.
After a moment's reflection, Brunetti added,
"It's safer than keeping stock there permanently."
And finally he said,
"It's like DHL. Delivery within 24 hours."
Vianello considered this and then asked,
"How is it that you sit here for 5 minutes and you see a system that might work, while people who've worked here or lived here for years haven't noticed anything?"
Brunetti thought about this before answering,
"They probably do know, Lorenzo, but they're not going to come and tell us. We're lepers. Well, sort of lepers. No one wants to be seen with us or talking to us because they'll end up having trouble. They live around here, remember."
"That's a bit exaggerated, wouldn't you say?"
"Of course it's exaggerated, but it's still what they think. After all, why should they bother? They know the same people will be doing the same thing in a few days or a week or a month. If they come in to report a crime, we'll take their name, and then someone might find out they talked to us."
Before Vianello could object, Brunetti said,
"I know that doesn't happen, but I'm talking about what people believe. And if they call, then we have their phone number, and we can find out who they are and come to ask them questions."
He turned and looked directly at Vianello.
"If you were an ordinary person, not a policeman, would you report a crime?"
Vianello ignored the question and asked,
"How's Fornari involved in this?"
Brunetti, suddenly aware of the cold sinking into him, got to his feet.
"I wish I knew."
He looked at his watch and saw that it was a bit before 6, one of those awkward times when it was too early to go home but too late to bother to go back to the Questura.
"There's nothing else for us to do here," Brunetti said. "We might as well go home."
"Are you calculating double time for the time we sat in the cold?"
Vianello asked. Brunetti laughed and clapped his friend on the shoulder. Chapter 16 Brunetti's good spirit stayed with him all the way home and came up the stairs with him. Raffi was in the kitchen, eating a prosciutto sandwich the same size as the Greek-Italian dictionary he held in his other hand. When he saw his father, he said, mouthful,
"This is to sustain life until dinner."
A silent Brunetti passed in front of him and pulled out the bottle of Ribolla Gialla they had not finished the evening before.
"So is this," he said, as he plunked it down on the counter and found a glass.
Then, with the cunning of the snake, Brunetti took another glass and tipped it towards Raffi.
"Want some?"
Mouth full with another bite, Raffi could only shake his head. He swallowed and said, holding up the sandwich,
"Not with this. I'd rather have water."
"Aha!" Brunetti's mental detective exclaimed. "No interest in alcohol, so perhaps none in drugs." He opened the refrigerator, and while Raffi continued eating, took a bottle of mineral water and poured his son a glass. Raffi stuffed the last piece of sandwich into his mouth and spoke around it.
"Thanks, Papa."
"Escaping text analysis?"
Brunetti asked, nodding at the dictionary. Raffi put his head back and rolled his eyes. Then he raised one finger in the air in a very professorial gesture and said,
"Adinotuan, tuan niven, pratunta, praven eth."
That said, He drank the water and set the empty glass in the sink with a sort of decisive click his mother made when turning a gesture into a statement, and went back towards his room.
"I would have recognized that years ago," Brunetti told himself, digging away at the Greek but failing to uncover the meaning.
Dinner was spent trying to decide whether to accept an invitation from Paola's parents to go to their house near Dobbiaco for the week between Christmas and New Year. Brunetti sat quietly, trying to enjoy his cod with spinach, while amusing himself by anticipating the three responses. Paola said she hated Dobbiaco, hated the cold, and no longer enjoyed skiing. Rafi said he'd love to go, but would have to check with Sara. Chiara, never one to disappoint, lamented the fact that the family had so many houses that they kept empty for much of the year, dismissing her mother's assertion that keeping staff year-round both ensured that the houses would be kept safe and saw that people had work, an argument Paola had perfected years ago to stifle Rafi's socialistic pronouncements about the ownership of property.
"That's not the point,"
Chiara went on, shifting gears in the high dudgeon she employed to move from reason to reason.
"It's an act of environmental vandalism to keep these places open and use up all the resources it takes to maintain them."
"Oh, don't be silly, Chiara," her mother said.
"You know your grandfather covered the roof with solar panels?"
Rafi chimed in, sounding pleased.
"He sells the extra energy to the electric company."
Brunetti remembered once having a son who was a declared enemy of capitalism, who longed to see the entire wicked system destroyed. How could he, the boy's father, and a policeman to boot, have failed to notice when the kidnappers from the European Central Bank came in and replaced his own son with a replicant?
"Does that mean you don't want to go, Angel?" Brunetti asked Chiara.
His question brought down the temperature of her fervor.
"I didn't say that, Papa," Chiara insisted. "I'd like to go. To get away from the pollution here."
There is an ecological justification for everything, Brunetti thought, but did not say.
"What about you, Papa?"
Rafi asked, perhaps mindful of his father's kindness in giving him a glass of water.
"I'd enjoy going, too."
"But you hate skiing,"
Chiara said instantly.
"But I love the mountains," Brunetti answered with a smile.
The subject drifted away after that, to be postponed until another time. Paola restored harmony, or rather her fresh chestnut and hazelnut cake restored harmony. It wasn't until later, as he lay in bed with Antigone in his hands and his wife at his side, that Brunetti recognized Rafi's quotation.
"Aristotle," he said aloud. "It is impossible for the man who does nothing to be happy."
The next morning he girded his loins when he got to his office and called down to his superior to ask if the vice questore had time to see him. Sighing heavily, Pata told him he could come now if he hurried. When Brunetti entered, having lingered in Dottor Patta's anteroom only long enough to ask Signorina Elettra if she could have a look at Fornari's private life, he found the dottore deeply engrossed in an open file. Hearing Brunetti come in, the vice questore, in the manner of St. Augustine in his study, when interrupted in his labors by the spirit voice of St. Jerome at the window, glanced first at the light coming from his left, and then at Brunetti, and then at the floor, as though in search of the little white dog who had so recently been sitting at his feet. After a moment he allowed his gaze to clear and return to the things of this world.
"What is it, Brunetti?" he inquired.
"It's about Signor Gasparini, Vice Questore," Brunetti said in a voice he kept low.
"Gasparini?" asked Pata. "You'll have to refresh my memory, Brunetti."
"Of course, Signore," Brunetti answered.
"Take a seat.
Pata said with easy command. Brunetti crossed to the chair he usually sat in when speaking to the Vice Questore.
The man who was found at the bottom of the bridge 2 nights ago.
Mugging, wasn't it?
It seemed that way, Signore, Brunetti said.
What do you mean, Brunetti?
Demanded an instantly suspicious Pater.
The attack might have been planned, Dottore.
By whom?
His wife came to see me a week ago. She told me she was worried that her son was using drugs.
Are you saying you think the son did it?
No, Signore, Brunetti said, with no sign of the exasperation he felt. Signor Gasparini might somehow have learned the name of the man who's selling drugs to the students in his son's school.
Brunetti was reluctant to explain that he had received the information from one of his informers. He paused to await Pata's comment or query.
And you think this led to the attack?
It's a possibility, Dottore, Brunetti answered mildly.
He made no comment on the lack of street crime in Venice, not wanting the Vice Questore to see it as a hidden criticism of his native city, Palermo. Pata sat back in his chair and folded his hands, fingers intertwined, across his stomach. Even the weight of his hands seemed unable to wrinkle the smoothness of his shirt.
What do you want me to do?
Nothing, sir. I wanted to alert you to the possible connection. I'd like to find the man said to be selling drugs to the students.
You have children, Pata said. Are you worried for them?
Less here than I would be in another city, Brunetti said, and then hastened to add, Milano, for example.
Pata nodded, leaned forward, and said,
I understand. All right. See what you can find out.
Thank you, sir, Brunetti said and got to his feet.
If he managed to tiptoe to the door and let himself out without another word, he might well be able to add this conversation to the short list of peaceful interchanges he'd had with Pata. Just as Brunetti reached the threshold, Pata said from behind,
Good luck, Brunetti.
Shocking him so that his hand almost slipped from the handle.
Thank you, sir, Brunetti said again and left.
Outside, he leaned back against the door and closed his eyes. He took 2 deep breaths, unable to believe what had just happened.
What is it, signore?
Signorina Elettra asked in a nervous voice.
Brunetti opened his eyes and saw her at her desk, one hand on the edge, as if she were about to push herself to her feet and come to his aid.
Are you all right?
Yes, he said in a whisper, holding up his hand. The Vice Questore just wished me good luck in finding a suspect.
She sat down, and Brunetti added, making his way towards her.
During the entire time I was there, he was pleasant and attentive to me.
There must be something wrong with him,
Signorina Elettra offered.
Or he wants something from me, Brunetti reasoned out loud.
You'd never tell him anything important, would you, Signore?
She asked. Brunetti held up the back of his right hand to her and pointed at the tips of his fingers with the index finger of the other.
Not without bamboo shoots being driven under my nails, he said.
She looked relieved.
I wonder what he's after.
Signorina Elettra took a piece of paper from her desk and extended it towards Brunetti. He saw that she had written the name of Fornari's wife, followed by a date and 2 sums in euros.
Since he's been out, he's been receiving a disability payment, and she's being paid to take care of him.
And the disability?
He asked, wondering what sort of scam Fornari and his wife were using now.
His prison records state that he was released for medical reasons,
she said.
Meaning?
The records state that he has health problems that can be more easily treated if he's at home with his family and able to get to the hospital for treatment.
Any mention of what the problem is?
It could be a serious illness,
she said, sounding not the least bit convinced.
My experience working here, however, suggests the possibility that he's figured out a way to have the social services pay both him and his wife a salary while he contracts out his drug business to the highest bidder.
Can you get into... Brunetti began, but quickly corrected himself. That is, can you check his hospital records and see if they give a reason?
I just started that, signore,
she said.
If you go upstairs, I'll tell you when I find something.
Signorina Elettra called a half hour later.
I found his hospital file. It's not good, and I was wrong.
What is it?
Lung cancer. The bad one. Well,
she temporized,
one of the bad ones. It's why they released him.
Do the records give you an idea of what shape he's in?
No. They name the type of chemotherapy he's being given and how many cycles he's had, and that's all.
How long has it gone on?
After a short delay, she said,
since he was released. He had two long cycles of chemo and then radiation, and now he's back in chemotherapy for the last 3 months, once every 3 weeks.
After a pause, she added,
his doctors decided he's too weak to get there by himself, so he's taken there by Sanitrans.
When was he last in the hospital?
He heard papers being turned, accompanied by a light humming sound. After some time, she was back, saying,
he had chemo last week, and he's scheduled for another cycle in 2 weeks.
And he's kept all of his appointments?
More paper noise, then.
Yes.
Good, Brunetti said.
His response had come unsummoned. Fornari was a drug dealer and an ex-convict, but he was also a man with cancer. After a long hesitation, she asked,
"Had you thought of one possibility, Commissario?"
"Such as?"
"If he's been in this business for a long time, then he has connections among his colleagues. He could run the business from his telefonino. All he'd need is a reliable courier."
"It's an interesting idea, signorina, and I thank you for it," Brunetti said.
Then he asked her to call him if she learned anything else, and replaced his phone. He pulled open his bottom drawer, rested his heels on it, and leaned back as far as his chair would permit, and studied the ceiling. For the first time he noticed a beige blot about the size of a compact disc, though with tentacles, descending from the place where the wall above the window on the left met the ceiling. Above his office was the mansard where, centuries before, the servants had lived. Up there, the rooms on this side of the building served as a general deposit for old furniture and filing cabinets, and were seldom visited. Low-ceilinged and wooden-floored, the rooms had few windows, and those very small. He had been there years before and had noted the state of the window frames. But his office was then on the other side of the building, so he had not seen a problem. In Fornari, however, he did see a problem. A man going through the chemotherapy prescribed for a particularly vicious kind of tumor was hardly likely to be delivering drugs to another part of the city, nor standing in front of a school in the cold selling drugs. He was even more unlikely to find sufficient strength to accost, assault, and hurl a man down the steps of a bridge. Brunetti reconsidered the spot on the wall. He was reluctant to see Fornari as a dead end, no matter how parlous his state of health. The wife, colleagues, a telephone. How easy it would be for Fornari to send someone else. He went over everything he had discovered about Gasparini, another man with a nice wife. At times it seemed to him as though Italy were a country filled with men who had nice wives. For heaven's sake, he was a man with a nice wife. He got to his feet, deciding in that instant to go and curiosare down at the far end of Castello. It would be better to go alone so that he and Fornari could have a quiet little talk, drug dealer to drug dealer. Chapter 17. He found the address in Cali Campielli e Canali, near the wall of the Arsenale that ran along the Rio delle Gorne. He couldn't remember the last time he had been in that neighborhood, though he did remember that there was a large tree in Campo delle Gorne, and a friend of his had once tried to sell him a half share in a boat that had a docking space along that wall. He'd refused the offer, knowing then, with Rafi just born, that the concerns of life could not include a boat. Boats belonged to the frivolity and freedom of youth, or to the endless, sometimes empty, hours of age. Most men had more than enough to occupy them with families and work. A boat was a girlfriend and not a wife. As he studied the map in Cali, Campielli e Canali, he hoped it would reanimate his feet's memory and take him there easily. He got lost only twice, and one time really didn't count. At the end of Calle dei Forlani, he started to turn right, but caught himself in time and turned left. A few minutes later, entering Campo do Pozzi, he continued straight across and walked to a dead end before he admitted defeat and turned back to the Campo and then to the left, down and out into Campo delle Gorne. A tall, attractive blonde woman stood by the edge of the canal, looking down at something in the water. A robust white dog sitting side-saddle at her feet. Brunetti approached and said, not knowing how he knew she was English, but so certain that she was that he addressed her in that language,
"Is something wrong, signora?"
"It's Martino's tennis ball," she said.
She smiled and added,
"Nothing to be done, I'm afraid."
Brunetti looked into the canal and saw the furry yellow ball floating off to the left.
"If I were 30 years younger, signore, I'd dive in and get it for you," he said impulsively.
If she had a dog, then she lived in the city. All the more reason for a bit of Italian galanteria. She laughed aloud, and years scattered from her. She turned to study his face.
"If I were 30 years younger, I'd want you to," she said.
Then, looking down at the dog, she said,
"Come along, Martino. We can't have everything we'd like."
She gave Brunetti another smile and turned back towards the church of San Martino Vescovo. Cheered by the encounter, Brunetti continued along the water and turned left into a narrow calle into which no light shone. The door was on his right, so low and broad as to seem almost square. He looked for a bell, and, finding none, knocked a few times. He waited a moment, knocked again, and when there was still no response, made a fist and pounded out 5 sharp blows. He heard a voice, then footsteps, and then the door was pulled back by a woman of about his own age, tall and too thin, who stepped out into the calle.
"Are you here to see Gianluca?"
she asked in a voice that expressed hope. She had red hair that had gone white at the roots 3 centimeters ago. The skin around her nose and mouth repeated the same colors, with small flecks peeling off irritated, reddened skin. Her eyes were lapis blue, so blue that for an instant Brunetti thought she must be wearing contact lenses. But she was not the sort of woman to bother with such things.
"Yes, I am," Brunetti answered without a smile.
She seemed not to expect one, and stepped back inside, holding the door open.
"Come in. He's upstairs."
Brunetti passed in front of her, careful not to say anything, and found himself in a damp corridor, a wooden staircase on one side. This might well have been one of the houses built for the workers in the Arsenale at the turn of the last century. Many of them had been transformed into bijou bed and breakfasts. This one had not. He climbed the stairs, heard her coming up behind him. When he reached the first floor landing, she said from behind, "To the right." He turned and saw another door, this one a proper rectangle, standing slightly ajar, light and heat emerging from it.
"Go in,"
she said, and moved up behind him, forcing Brunetti towards the door. He pushed it open without asking permission and entered a low room with a beamed ceiling, though not beamed in the way he was accustomed to seeing. These beams were worm-eaten and encrusted with dark remnants of the smoke that must have poured from the sort of coal-burning stove he remembered his grandparents had used. There were two windows, close together, but whatever stood on the other side of the glass was obscured by the humidity that covered and trickled down the surface. The condensation made Brunetti all the more conscious of the heat that seemed to pour from the walls as well as from the two electric heaters that stood in front of the sofa, on which half lay, half sat, a pale-faced man with long, lank hair. It was almost noon, yet no light came through the windows. Brunetti didn't know if it was due to the narrowness of the calle or the height of the surrounding buildings. He knew only that he was in a trap, or a cave, or a prison cell. The man looked across at him.
"Who are you?"
"My name's Guido."
"Did they send you?"
"Yes,"
Brunetti answered, putting as much impatience as he could into the monosyllable.
"What do they want?"
The man's voice was a smoker's voice, slimy and unpleasant. Brunetti smiled, pulled over a chair, and sat without being asked.
"What do you think they want, Signor Fornari?"
Brunetti turned to look over his shoulder and saw the woman standing at the door.
"Does she have to be here?"
he asked roughly.
"No,"
Fornari said.
"Get out."
The woman obeyed and surprised Brunetti by closing the door quietly. When Brunetti glanced back at the other man, it looked as though he had fallen asleep. His face was flushed, either by the heat or by whatever drugs he was being given, or perhaps by the illness itself. Fornari might once have been handsome. His nose was thin and fine, the arch of his brows strangely elegant. Well-defined full lips contradicted the cadaverous cheeks above them. He opened his eyes, gray and faintly cloudy, and asked,
"Will they wait?"
"You should know better than to ask that, Signor Fornari," Brunetti said with exaggerated politeness.
"I've always paid them on time. I've been a good client,"
he insisted.
The wetness of the voice, as though some soggy thing were trapped in his throat, set Brunetti's teeth on edge.
"That was then," Brunetti said impassively. "This is now."
When he had drifted away, Farnari's head had tipped to his right side, and now he had to struggle to push himself upright. Brunetti saw his hands, little more than claws, push at the seat of the sofa, drag a pillow from behind his back. He thought of the man's voice and quelled the impulse to move close enough to help him.
"My wife took the money last night. You got it, didn't you?"
Brunetti confined himself to nodding.
"So why did they tell her they're getting a new supplier?"
"For the Albertini, you mean?"
Brunetti asked. Fornari flashed him a surprised look. He was weak, but he was no fool. He nodded, but his expression was wary. Brunetti put on a shrewd face and said,
"We've got someone who can take care of both, the Albertini and Marco Polo. Besides, look at you. How much longer do you think you can run things?"
Then he added, not bothering to disguise his contempt,
You think no one's noticed your wife? You think she's able to do this?
Then, raising his voice and taking it closer to anger, Brunetti asked,
You think we'd take a chance of using her? Might as well hire a circus clown.
He forced out a small, deprecating laugh, as though Fornari had told him a joke that wasn't very funny.
Is that why there was no delivery today?
Fornari asked. All suspicion vanished.
What do you think? Brunetti demanded.
Then what happens to us?
Fornari asked, voice wobbling towards panic. He was interrupted by an enormous cough that pulled him forward to the edge of the sofa. There followed another, and another, and then an extended series of long choking noises that made Brunetti want to flee the room. The door opened and the woman was there, a clean white towel in her hands. She bent over the choking man and turned him towards the back of the sofa and onto his side. She wedged the towel between his face and the sofa, then lifted his legs and put them on the seat. The coughing continued, wet and horrible and filled with the approach of death. Nothing, no one, could survive the power of that cough. Lungs could not remain in place with that savage force filling the room. Brunetti got to his feet and went out into the corridor. He closed the door and stood there for what seemed a long time, listening to a life being coughed away. Finally, with gasps and pauses and long moments of silence, the coughing slowed to a stop. Brunetti unclasped his fists and pulled his hands from his pockets. After another few minutes, the woman emerged from the room. She looked at Brunetti, making no attempt to veil her contempt for his weakness.
He's asleep. You can go.
He started down the steps, the woman close behind him, as though she wanted to be sure she saw the last of him. When they got to the bottom, he waited for her. She walked past without looking at him and opened the door.
What did they tell you when you took the money last night?
That they didn't want me. They've got someone new to do the deliveries. I'm fired.
Her face screwed up as though she were going to cry. But then she breathed a long sigh, almost of relief. Anger or impatience colored her voice.
I told you I'm fired.
Then, with the same suspiciousness as the man, she asked,
Didn't they tell you?
He shrugged, as though it was the sort of thing that happened in all big companies. Failure of information transfer from one division to another. No prompt updating of human resources policy. Delayed termination notice. He walked in front of her, again without excusing himself, and left the apartment. She didn't bother to slam the door. Chapter 18 As he started back towards the Questura, Brunetti thought over his conversation with Patta. Luckily, he had told the Vice Questore only that there was a possibility of a connection between Gasparini and the drug dealer. The coughing shadow he had just spoken to was not the person who had accosted Gasparini on the bridge, nor did his wife seem to be a person capable of such a thing. Fornari lacked the strength to make a phone call. He could never have organized the attack on Gasparini. So here it was, the one obvious connection between victim and suspect coughed away. He needed to go back to the beginning, start from there, looking at things he might have dismissed while considering Professoressa Crosera's son's possible involvement in drugs. He took his phone and dialed Grifoni's number.
See?
She answered.
I'll be there in 10 minutes.
She was at her desk, which she saw had been moved and now faced the wall. Though this forced her to look at the cracks and peeling paint from a distance of little more than half a meter, it allowed her visitor the luxury of not having to sit in the open doorway. By serpenting past the back of her chair, another person could now sit in the other chair, as small as a stool, and talk to her with the door closed. Yet departure had to be negotiated by the two people sharing the office to decide who was to move first. Brunetti stopped at the open door and swiveled his head to study the tiny space.
"Putting the desk there gives the room a sense of grandeur," he said, and slipped past her to sit in the guest chair.
Smiling, she closed the door and turned to him.
"What is it?"
she asked. When he hesitated, she added,
"You sounded stressed on the phone."
He had decided to tell her without preliminaries.
"I went to see Fornari. He's dying of lung cancer in a pit of a house in Castello, and could no more attack anyone than he could rise up on angel wings and fly to the hospital for chemotherapy."
"So where does that leave us?"
"With evidence that Gasparini was attacked, but no one to suspect for it."
"You're excluding a random attack?"
she asked.
"Absolutely," he said, and resisted the impulse to add, "This is Venice, after all."
She moved forward in her chair, as though preparing to stand, but abandoned the attempt and turned to face him more fully. He noticed that she was wearing a black T-shirt and a black woolen jacket. The single strand of pearls looked real. He knew the blonde of her hair was.
"That's good," she said. "That you don't think it was random."
"Why?"
"Because then there's a motive, and once there's a motive, there will be evidence leading back to it."
Brunetti believed the same thing.
"There's knowing, and then there's finding," he said.
She leaned against the back of her chair and picked up a notebook and pen.
"Tell me everything you've learned."
It took him a long time to tell her. What Professoressa Crosera had told him, this time in greater detail, her refusal to allow him to speak to their son, and his chance meeting with the boy, and the boy's aggressive behavior. He finished with his visit to Fornari and his wife, and the misery of the place, though it had been, he realized only now, clean and tidy. There had been no mess or clutter, and Fornari wore freshly ironed pajamas. It was the cough, Brunetti admitted, but only to himself, that had dirtied the place. When he was finished, Grifoni closed the notebook and placed it to the side of her desk.
"Nothing in there," she began, waving towards the notebook, "would lead me anywhere."
She paused, considered, and then corrected herself.
"Except back to Professoressa Crosera. I think it's worth talking to her again."
Brunetti was in complete agreement with this. He knew how adept Grifoni could be at playing good cop, especially with female witnesses.
"All right. I'll see if she'll talk to us. Maybe we can—"
Grifoni broke in to say,
"If she's at the hospital, it shouldn't be there. That would be too much for her."
Brunetti pulled out his telefonino and held it up. Grifoni nodded, and he found and keyed in the number. It rang 9 times, 10, and on the 11th she picked it up and said her name.
"Signora, it's Commissario Brunetti. How is your husband?"
"As you saw him the last time. He's still here. There's been no change."
"Ah," Brunetti sighed. "I'm very sorry for your trouble, signora, but I'm afraid I have to add to it."
"Did you find the person you think attacked him?"
she asked, in a far more neutral voice than Brunetti would have expected. But then it occurred to him, what difference was there between knowing and not knowing, really?
"No, we haven't. That's why I'd like to come and talk with you again."
"Here?"
she asked, sounding alarmed.
"No. At your home, if you would permit that."
"What good would it do?"
He realized that finding the guilty person would do no one any good at all, and never would. It would do bad to the person who had committed the crime and to their family. It could do bad to the family of the victim, too, for all they'd have was the temptation of vengeance, and Brunetti had seen how quickly vengeance corrupted all who went near it.
"It's not my job to do good, Signora," he admitted. "Only to find the guilty person and see that they are arrested."
"What will that change?" she asked.
Her voice was very low. He had to struggle to hear it. He thought he could hear rattling noises in the background, but he wasn't sure.
"When would you like to come?"
she suddenly asked, surprising him.
"After lunch, perhaps? Would 3 o'clock be convenient for you?"
"Yes,"
she said, and hung up.
"She's agreed," Brunetti told Grifoni.
"Good," Grifoni said. "It will be better in her home, I think."
"Because she'll be more relaxed?" Brunetti asked.
"Yes,"
Grifoni answered and got to her feet.
"And because we can take a look around."
They had lunch together. Brunetti had called Paola to tell her he had to talk to someone, and she'd been completely accepting of his news, explaining that the children would be content with what she gave them, so long as there was a lot of it.
"Work?"
he asked, wondering if she had a paper to prepare or exams to correct.
"Reading,"
she said, and left it at that. At lunch, he and Grifoni talked about a case that was filling the local papers concerning a doctor from Egypt who was accused of having killed his 16-year-old daughter, having found what he considered flirtatious messages on her Facebook account sent by a boy in her class, an Italian boy. One of the messages that had driven the man to murder was, "Your answer in history class today was very good." Another time the boy wrote, "Do you have time for a coffee after class?" Because the father was no adept at following the order of messages on Facebook, he did not notice that she had not responded to the first and had said no to the second. The father had stabbed her while she was asleep, later telling the police that he could not have done it if she had been awake and looking at him. He loved her too much. Brunetti and Grifoni spoke of the incident with the despair that comes at the realization of human prejudice and stupidity.
"She was 16 years old, and he killed her because a boy asked if she wanted to have a coffee, for the love of God," Grifoni said. "If I think of what I was doing when I was 16,
she began, and covered her eyes with her right hand.
"You aren't the Egyptian," Brunetti said.
"Neither was she," Grifoni shot back. "She came here when she was 3 years old. Is she supposed to behave as if she'd been raised in a tent in the desert?"
"The father says he wants to die. Wants us to kill him."
"Oh, Guido, give it a rest, would you?"
she shot back, hiding neither her surprise nor her anger.
"What does that mean?"
he asked, startled by her vehemence. At the approach of the waiter with their pasta, both stopped talking. As soon as he was out of hearing, Brunetti repeated,
"Tell me what that means."
Grifoni sprinkled cheese on her pasta, speared some more peas one by one, then a final piece of yellow pepper before twirling her fork full of tagliolini. The pasta remained suspended on the end of her fork while she looked at him.
"It means it's all nonsense. He doesn't want to die. He wants to suck up to Westerners and make them believe his heart is broken because he murdered his daughter."
She set her fork down and put her face in her hands, but continued speaking.
"He isn't content with having murdered her. Now he wants sympathy because he's a victim trapped between two cultures."
She removed her hands and picked up her fork.
"It makes me want to scream. It's all so orchestrated and fake."
"You really think that? You don't believe him?"
This time her fork slammed against her plate.
"No, I don't believe him. And I don't believe those old men who say they had to kill their poor, suffering wives
because they just couldn't stand to see the woman they loved become another person because of Alzheimer's.
She made a fist and set it on the table.
Tell me when you've ever read about a woman giving the same excuse for murdering her husband.
Brunetti noticed that the people at the next table were looking at them nervously.